A single F1 piston, including its development and manufacture, can cost over £50,000. There's no doubt, they are incredible engineering. But I wanted to understand more about how they're made. So I went to Cosworth to understand the life of a piston, from design all the way to the dyno and every step in between. And it was genuinely one of the most interesting days I've ever had. So, where do we start when creating a piston that can rev to 20,000 RPM? Well, it all starts with design. The design process takes 4 to 8 weeks, depending on how far the team go with the optimization of the piston. The journey begins with a fundamental question. What kind of engine are the team designing for? Whether it's a V12, a V10, a V8, or another configuration, these choices significantly impact the design of the piston. And there are a few critical things that need to be decided from the start. The first of which being understanding how many cylinders the engine will have. But nowadays, this will mostly be defined by the regulations. Then the team must figure out the optimum bore and stroke dimensions. Bore is the diameter of the cylinder, and therefore piston, and the stroke is the distance the piston travels in the cylinder. And finally, the positioning of the valves is also very important. These decisions make a big difference to how the piston looks and works. For example, if the stroke is longer, the piston needs to travel further up and down, so it will move faster and experience greater forces. So it might need to be taller and stronger to handle this increased stress. On the other hand, if the stroke is shorter, the design can be more compact because the piston moves slower and will experience less stress. In the same way, where the valves are placed affects the top of the piston, otherwise known as the crown. And it's this part at the top that's really important to how the fuel is burnt. Now, Cosworth has been around since 1958, and they supplied some of the most successful F1 engines from 1963 to 2013, many of which they still rebuild for customers today. They're also behind cutting-edge engines like the one in Adrian Newey's V12 Valkyrie. Anyway, with all that being said, they've made quite a few pistons over the years, so they don't need to start these designs from scratch.
We've got quite a good database built up from all of the pistons we've done in the past. So kind of initially, it's designed based off all of our previous data. We know roughly how thick the different areas need to be.
Once the fundamental dimension and configuration decisions are made, the first thing to be designed is the forge tool. Most of the time, piston manufacture begins with forging. A forge machine shapes the piston by heating a block of metal to a high temperature and then pressing it into a mold, forming the piston's basic structure under massive pressure. It's a huge and very hot machine, which I'll cover later in this video. Then the design attention moves to the piston crown, the top surface of the piston that directly interacts with the combustion chamber, again where the fuel mixture is burnt. And the shape of the crown is critical, as it heavily influences how the air-fuel mixture burns inside the cylinder. A well-designed crown can optimize combustion efficiency, meaning more power and more efficient use of fuel. To design the crown, the engineers use this software called Siemens NX. That lets them create a detailed model of the piston and the combustion chamber. They can then analyze the shape of the inlet and exhaust ports, figure out where to put the valves, and design the overall shape of the crown and the combustion chamber. The whole point is to come up with a crown shape that mixes the fuel and air really well. That way, the fuel burns completely and there's less chance of knocking or detonation.
So for things like the fatigue safety factor, we've then gone and looked at the previous pistons we've ran that ran successfully, what were their safety factors in those areas? And that can mean we can kind of run things on a lower safety factor than if we didn't have that data to validate.
The design of the piston crown is an iterative process and involves quite a lot of analysis. Engineers start with a basic shape, then refine it based on the results of a number of software simulations. These simulations help find areas where the design can be improved or where it might break. The regions that experience high stress or a lot of heat. By tweaking the design of the crown, the team can reduce their stresses to create a more durable and potentially more powerful engine. And while the crown gets much of the attention, the underside of the piston is equally as important. It's where the piston's strength and durability are really determined. But before we get into that, you may remember that we recently launched our F1 carbon embedded wallet, and we did the successful launch through a Shopify site. If you haven't heard of Shopify, it's a commerce platform that allows you to start, grow, and manage a business. And setting up our beautiful Shopify site was incredibly easy. And its integrations allowed us to sell across all the major social media platforms. Shopify is improving commerce with its simple drag and drop store editor, easy to use marketing tools, and a back office that oversees all of our operations. It also has the best converting checkout on the planet, outperforming the competition by up to 36%. Millions of entrepreneurs in over 170 countries use Shopify to power their businesses every day. Shopify is powering the next generation of entrepreneurs. So if that sounds like you, you can start your free trial today at shopify.com/driver61. That's shopify.com/driver61. Now, back to the video. The designers must carefully balance the thickness and height of the walls on the underside, as well as things like the pin size. The pin being the cylindrical part that connects the piston to the connecting rod, allowing the piston to pivot as it moves up and down the cylinder.
But we normally work to a slightly higher safety factor, but we then use that work to kind of iterate on the piston design. So it can highlight areas that have a really high safety factor we can now take mass out of, or it'll highlight areas that we've kind of pushed the limits a bit too much and just need to add some material back in.
But the first goal is to make sure the piston isn't going to break while keeping its weight as low as possible. Remember, when a piston is reciprocating so quickly, every single gram counts. And as with the crown, the underside design is refined through a series of simulations. These simulations help the team understand how the piston will behave under real-world conditions, like the high pressures and temperatures experienced in an F1 engine. By finding and fixing potential weak points, the engineers can make sure the piston will perform reliably, even under these very extreme conditions. So, after the design process is done and validated, the designer makes a proper drawing for the piston that's ready for manufacture. And the tolerances the team are working to are incredibly small. For example, the piston rings and their grooves have a tolerance of between 10 and 20 microns. That's 0.01 of a millimeter. The precision of these pistons is wild, but they need to be. If the rings are too tight, they'll stick. And if they're too loose, they won't do their job properly.
You obviously don't want the ring to be sticky or to stick in the groove, but you don't want it to have a lot of free play either. That's bad for blow-by and oil consumption.
Once the piston is designed, it's time to head to manufacturing. And the process begins with forging. Here, a small billet of aluminium is heated to between 400 and 500 degrees Celsius and then shaped into the piston using a huge press. And this is where the forge tool that was previously designed comes into play.
So you can see that's effectively the undercrown shape, but the negative of the undercrown. So that's the tool that will be fitted in that presses down. So these are made out of a really tough tool steel, and again, they're super finished, so they're really smooth.
Maintaining a consistent temperature of the material during forging is critical. The aluminium billet is only removed from the heater when it's ready to go into the forging machine, ensuring that it doesn't lose any heat. And there's a lot to the forging tool itself.
See, we've got features there to locate it, and then two big heaters go in there with a thermocouple in the middle so that this whole tool is heated. Then on the side, you've got some vent holes. So looking down, there'll be some slight holes, so that's to let any of the gas out, so we don't end up with a trapped pocket of gas. And then you've obviously got all of the different fingers for the different pockets on the undercrown.
Once in the machine, the forging tool is pressed into the billet, forming the piston under massive pressure. The forged piston is then taken out and left to cool. But the process isn't yet over.
Because the forge is at 400-500 degrees C, any heat treatment that's previously been done on the material is lost. So we then need to go and heat treat the forgings, as well as clean off any of the muck from the forging process.
They need to return the aluminium to its T6 condition, meaning it's been heat treated and so is stronger. This works by heating the piston in an oven to the right temperature for a set amount of time, then quickly cooling it down with water, air or oil, a process known as quenching. And you might ask, why are the parts forged? Why aren't they machined? Well, the perks of forging are twofold. First, it aligns the grain structure with the shape of the piston, making it better at handling stress. And it's also cost effective because it cuts down on the production time, meaning less time spent on the expensive machining.
And we normally do batches of probably 30 to 100 pistons, but it's the kind of thing where you wouldn't want to be machining from a solid billet for every single one of those.
By the way, F1 pistons are made out of aluminium because of Formula One's regulations. They're now not allowed to use anything more exotic. But there are better materials out there, such as metal matrix composites, which are made by embedding strong ceramic particles with a metal matrix, typically aluminium, to enhance strength, wear resistance and thermal stability. And this is the material that Cosworth uses in the impressive Gordon Murray V12 engine that they produce. So the piston is forged and it kind of looks like the final product. Surely it's time to get it machined. Well, actually, no. First, the team need to program the CNC machines. Now, these things are huge and extremely complicated. So once the design has been approved, the drawings and the software designs are forwarded to the programming team, who will then program the designs for the machining process. The piston design process is guided by a DFM philosophy. Design for manufacture. So during the design phase, the designer will always ensure the piston can actually be manufactured on the CNC machine, as it would be really easy to design something that couldn't in fact be machined. Depending on the complexity of the piston design, it usually takes between 30 and 50 processes on the machine to finish each piston. The more processes and the more changing of machine bits, the longer the piston takes to make. And more machine time means more expense. So it's important to figure out how to lower the number of processes and use the machine time as efficiently as possible.
It means you can't run the programs too hard, because you could probably run it quicker and you get parts quicker, but if you break it all over the weekend, you've made nothing, yeah. So some of it's trying to make it reliable.
Then, using software called Vericut, they can simulate the entire machining process based on the designs and the forging program that's been provided. But since no program is perfect, they'll still go through an iterative cycle. Programming the design, testing the machinery for accuracy, and if the cuts or markings aren't up to scratch, they'll go back to tweaking the program. And this back and forth process can take up to 4 days. So with the machining process sorted, it's time for the first piston to be machined. They first do this as a one-off to make sure that everything runs smoothly once they leave the machines running.
So you still need someone on the machine to kind of prove out the program, make sure it all works. And again, then Sir Russell, who does quality, will then often look at it and mark up areas that the chatter marks are a bit too deep. So then the program needs to be refined to basically improve the surface finish.
Chatter is when the cutting tool and piston vibrate, causing an imperfect finish. And chatter will happen if the machine is trying to run too quickly. So it's up to the programming team to find the balance between speed and the quality of the machining. So it's finally time to head to the machines. Each individual piston takes between 2 and 6 hours of machining time, and after a few hours of rumble, which is when you put the piston into an abrasive material and vibrate it, causing the piston to become smoother and more polished. And as you can imagine, managing different jobs on these machines and ensuring they're running at capacity is a difficult balance. And an entire batch of pistons can take 4 to 6 weeks to be produced. So the forged piston is then added to these huge CNC machines, specifically the DMG DMU 50. This is a full 5-axis machine weighing about 7.5 tons and costing hundreds of thousands of pounds. And it has a pallet loader, which can hold up to 40 different parts, meaning that the machine can be set up and left running overnight producing pistons. And this thing is incredible. Just watching it running is mesmerizing, as it changes tools, parts, and moves around so very quickly. The machining begins on the underside of the piston, removing material that wasn't possible to be removed during the forging process.
As much as we forged it, you're not able to forge any undercut pockets. Things like the pin bore will need machining out.
So this piston has no crown machining yet. We've just undercrown machines, so put a pin bore in and done all of these undercuts.
Once this is done, the undercrown is polished to remove any marks and smooth out the surfaces. Then the piston is turned over and the general crown shape and the valve pockets are machined.
We've only turned it to kind of a nominal diameter, but we've now machined on all the crown features. So this would now be ready to go into the Takasawa and have the turning.
And this is where things get even more precise. This is a Takasawa CNC machine. It's basically a high precision lathe, and it's used for turning the piston and shaping it to very precise dimensions and tolerances. It can work with precision down to just a few microns. And to add context, a human hair is about 70 microns thick. And because everything needs to be so precise, all of this machinery is in a temperature controlled room to make sure there's no thermal expansion.
If you just held the piston, about 10 seconds, it'll go out of tolerance.
So the piston goes onto the Takisawa lathe and the precise diameter is machined. And what's even more interesting here is that the pistons aren't actually round. There's in fact a slight oval to them, and the skirt is also oval.
So by starting with a slight oval, effectively as it gets squished, it brings it into more of a round shape, which again means we can run tighter clearances all the way around, which is better for blow-by and oil consumption.
The Takisawa machine synchronises the oval turning with the piston doing up to 3,000 RPM, meaning that it can turn something oval that's spinning up to 50 times per second. So the lathe has to move up and down very quickly and accurately to do so. Then the final part of the piston to be machined is the pin bore, the hole in the piston where the piston pin, or wrist pin, connects the piston to the connecting rod. And you might expect this just to be a normal hole drilled into the piston. But it's not. The pin bore is actually shaped with a slight curve because the piston pin bends when the fuel and air mixture explodes on top of the piston. And this slight curve in the piston bore ensures that even when the pin flexes, it stays in good contact with the bore, maintaining maximum contact area and evenly distributing the load.
And that's something the analysis engineers will, in their full model, look at how much the pin deflects and how to shape that pin bore to get the perfect contact.
Once the piston machining is finished, it goes through a final rumbling process and then gets coated. For racing engines, Cosworth apply a black DLC, diamond-like carbon, coating. The coating is incredibly hard, wear-resistant and reduces friction, which is critical for high-performance engines. Even though the DLC coating is very thin, measuring just a few microns, it's carefully accounted for during the machining process to ensure all the dimensions remain precise.
Particularly with the DLC coating, all the dimensions should be after coating, and that's accounted for during the machining process. So where things are coated, they might machine everything slightly smaller.
Throughout the entire machining process, the piston undergoes multiple inspections for finish and dimensions. This includes both manual checks and measurements using a coordinate measuring machine, or CMM, which can measure in three axes with precision down to just microns. But despite all the precision involved in the design, forging and machining processes, it's not 100% foolproof. To ensure safety and reliability, pistons must be checked for cracks, which could lead to catastrophic failure if left undetected. Cracks can occur during heat treatment when the aluminium, which is heated up to 500 degrees Celsius, cools and then hardens too quickly. This rapid cooling can cause structural problems, as the metal may not fuse properly at the joints. Surface cracks that develop during machining or handling also need to be identified and addressed, because under the intense conditions inside an engine, these cracks can grow and cause the piston to fail.
Those cracks are important because they'll be the initiation points for any bigger stress failures. Should the piston run in an engine. So as soon as the piston has some of those cracks, it needs to be scrapped and not used. It'll just become a much bigger failure.
To detect these cracks, the team performs crack testing using a penetrant dye that glows under UV light, coated with the penetrant and left to allow the dye to seep into any cracks. After wiping away the excess dye, the part is placed under UV light, where any cracks will be highlighted by the dye that remains in them. This process ensures that even the smallest defects are identified, and if they have a problem, the pistons are scrapped before they can cause any failures in the engine. If you're looking for a motorsport job, please take a look at fluidjobs.com and set up some job alerts. And if you're not quite ready, check out our motorsport career preparation tool, link in the description. So with the pistons checked for quality, it's finally time to assemble the engine. The build takes place in the build shop, where the piston is combined with other engine components. Like the rest of the facility, the engine build shop is absolutely spotless, and it's temperature controlled to ensure all the parts are precisely sized and fit together perfectly. The team follows a build plan to ensure the engine is assembled properly and all bolts are tightened to the correct torque, and then components like the valves are set up correctly.
Are you measuring how far up and down the valves are going to move?
While I was in the shop, I got to see an old F1 block with the pistons installed, and it was fascinating to see how the pistons move within the cylinder. And just look at how short the stroke is.
You can see there's really not a lot of difference between top dead and bottom dead center.
Then, once the engine is fully assembled, it's time to put it to test on the dyno. The dyno is a critical part of the process where the engine's performance and durability are evaluated under controlled conditions. For a new engine, the dyno testing process is comprehensive, involving a series of durability tests and simulations to ensure the engine can handle the demands of racing.
I think we'd run a durability cycle of Monza, given that's one of the most damaging circuits, but we would actually do an extended version. So we'd go to something like 1.5 times the engine life, so that we can ensure that when at the engine life we've stated, the engine shouldn't have durability issues.
The dyno simulates each lap of a circuit like Monza, pushing the engine through the same stresses it would face on the track, including throttle, RPM, and gear shifts. And this testing makes sure that the engine can not only perform at peak levels, but also endure the long-term wear and tear that comes with racing. If the engine design is already proven and doesn't require a full durability test, Cosworth will run a shorter dyno cycle. This is primarily to break the engine in and check for any other issues that might arise.
So the idea is just to break all the engine components in, and then there will be at least one power test to make sure that kind of at all RPMs, the engine's making the power we'd be expecting.
And during the dyno testing, a team of engineers closely monitor the vital stats, such as oil and water temperatures, oil pressure, RPM, and fuel flow. They constantly watch these parameters to ensure the engine is running smoothly and safely. And if any unusual readings are detected, indicating a potential problem, the team is ready to make real-time adjustments. The dyno even includes cameras that allow the team to visually inspect the engine for fluid leaks, as well as sensors that detect minute vibrations. These sensors are critical for identifying issues like bearing wear or imbalance early on, allowing the team to make any changes before it might become a serious problem. Once the engine has passed all its tests on the dyno, it's ready to leave the factory, get installed into a car, and finally hit the track. And each engine and its components has a specified lifespan, which is determined by factors like mileage and operational parameters. And the lifespan is usually down to the number of miles that the engine does, but it can be reduced by things like hitting the rev limiter or running at high temperatures. When the engine reaches the end of its mileage, it's not the end of the road. The engine will then be returned to the experts at Cosworth, where it will be stripped down and rebuilt for another cycle of use.
It would come back, be stripped down and rebuilt, with kind of all the relevant parts changed that have used up their life. But equally, there may be parts that can be reused.
Certain parts of the engine, like the block, the head, and the crankshaft, can often be reused for multiple engine life cycles. However, for components like the piston, which experience extreme stress, it's typically the end of their service life after just one cycle.
The piston very much is a highly stressed part, having that the temperature and just the forces from the combustion pressure above and that inertial force of particularly the high RPM engines. They're nearly always changed at a rebuild. I wouldn't expect to do 2 lifetimes on the piston.
So there you have it, the life of an F1 piston. Thanks to Shopify for sponsoring today's video. Thank you very much to Cosworth for hosting me. And if you'd like to understand how an F1 gearbox works, I recently took one apart. You can watch that video just up here. Thank you very much for watching, and please consider subscribing.